Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Masonic Effects, just a short opportunity to lean in, have a conversation, talk about things that seem to be pertinent to Masons. Today I'm working with a theme, and I want to, it's really formed around a question that came to mind a couple of months ago about the end game of this whole thing that we call Freemasonry and all its many facets. I'm not really clear that about the end game, because of what I see there. Of course, there's the ideals and the philosophy and values, but not everybody holds to the belief that Masonry is philosophically oriented. There are those that would suggest it's fundamentally an ideology. Difficulty with that, but it raises an interesting question about the end game of this. As we progress, we seem to have need to redefine or reconfigure or invigorate, incentivize. Those types of things come to mind, and yet for some it never crosses their mind because of the primacy that they've discovered. And I say this as they, because it is a group initiative. You create that atmosphere and that quid pro quo that works around the and protects a common notion. I think of it as like the common notion of artists and actors when they're sitting down to perform a play. There's a common purpose. There's an energy, a synergy, of course. Then does that cross your mind when we're thinking about our order, the order of ancient and accepted Freemasons? And I only say that, use that term because of the limits of my background. I realize the philosophy, ideas, science has nothing to do with gender, nothing at all. Truth has nothing to do with belief, faith, nothing to do with gender. The question that comes to mind is about the point. Is this, and I don't mean to be glib, we repeat go to go through our performance, our catechism, and then thereafter repeat. Is that, and then just never, there was never the question of what next. And I would think maybe that's where we find, if that's the case, it would begin to find the struggle, you know, that is that all there is kind of thinking. Well, the measure of that is, I think, I want to believe, the creativity, the spirituality that men bring forward to with them in terms of what they're seeking as a participant in the Masonic experience, their aim in life. Well, it's not a question that I'm going to be able to answer for you. But within it, there's another, and that speaks to the kind of theme, I guess, loose theme that I have running through this program today. We're going to, in the poetry section, only a slight departure. We're talking about an essay written by Ralph Waldo Emerson, the transcendental poet. Mm-hmm. This is, of course, his essay on self-reliance. And it came to mind that it may be relevant to the purpose. Is the aim of Freemasonry to help you develop a sense of self-reliance? Well, or is it to lean in and have us become part of a mutual support, dependent on the larger group to define us and our worth? I'm not explaining it very well, am I? But I think you know where I'm coming from. It's a good program today. The commentary today, the skit, I like that term. No profits, just sense. But to start us off, I have some pretty decent music. This is from the work of Paul Desmond. Yeah. I hope you enjoy the show. Oh, Work. Here, let me help clarify a few things today. Do you ever ask yourself the question about, you know, do we ever worry about it within the framework of Masonry about being led very effectively by those who know more about how to lead than where to lead us? Ask yourself the question, eh? How's that determined? I want to believe that it's scholarship, that it's an analysis of ethics that leads us forward, because I want to believe that Freemasonry is the embodiment of a values-based organization and designed to instruct a way of living, and the possibilities, the favorable possibilities, favorable not only for the individual but for society around us. It's a difficult worry to hold without putting it out there. So maybe it will be a little come into focus just a little bit more as you sit back and listen to the commentary today. And it begins with a short quote from William Shakespeare, As You Like It. Oh, spoiler alert, a little later on, as we get into Emerson's work, he'll refer to some material by John Fletcher, who was the person that is considered sort of the follower, the next great poet to Shakespeare. So just in case it ever crossed your mind. But it is a melancholy of my own, compounded by many simples, extracted from many objects, and indeed the sundry contemplation of my travels, which, by often rumination, wraps me in the most humorless sadness. Even though you may not have opportunity in Lodge, you may have needed to talk about expansive ideas. You have wondered what it would be like to explore ideas at your own pace. Well, let's try that here. If you will accept sonic effects as a pastiche, not to replace but enhance Lodge experience between gatherings, then I will ask you a few questions, if you don't mind. First, if your attitude changes, will you admit it to yourself? By surrounding yourself with beauty and wisdom, you breathe an atmosphere that will change you as surely as light conquers darkness. Now, at your age, is the preservation and enhancement of your life too frivolous to take seriously? After life meters out piety, you realize spirituality is occurring by your own measure, that this brotherhood cannot complete you, but can strive to be an incentive to cover the chamber with inspiration as graffiti and open the door of your mind as you enter. Nothing else. The clamor at the door, that's not an indictment of our speculations. It's a reflection of the human condition. We are the continuance of an ancient brotherhood. Our lessons require understanding and acquiring a vocabulary to communicate using a language of symbols and ritual, a blend of inspiration, experience, and contemplation. I know, except for in the rashness of youth, applying ideas like enlightenment and wisdom can be daunting. To overcome that natural reaction requires prerequisite humility, self-discipline, and self-respect. Even as you progress, ask yourself questions again and again. And together we will listen for changes as time and discovery deepens our understanding. Thank you. It's a reasonable question to ask about the direction that we're moving in. I know I would agree, and I think you and hope you would, that generally what unifies us is this search for what's called wisdom. It's a desire. It occurs that some of the ideas that we're talking about within Masonry and within our own search for understanding may transcend, may go beyond this discussion, perfect forms or sensibility. Maybe some of this knowledge can't be formulated around philosophical claims and arguments, but maybe part of it is more intuitive and more intuitively and experientially linked to an aesthetic experience. Is that not a wisdom? Isn't that not fundamental? We sit back a little bit. I want to share with you some ideas about the work of Emerson. It was first published in 1841. Only important, I think, because of the whatever context you make of that, what you know about that period. Ideas didn't necessarily start like taking a pair of scissors and cutting across history. There was thinking seems to evolve. And then spread, and then evolve, and then spread or die and off, you know. This is the first edition of Essays. There was he included a line in Latin: "Do not seek outside yourself." And then he entered a six-line stanza from Beaumont and Fletcher's Honest Man's Fortune. It's a play, and I think it's worth a look. And then he included a four-line stanza that Emerson wrote himself. He was a bright man. He was a philosophical voice in the 19th century. It, you can imagine if you looked at our around our lodge and said, well, nobody really cares. Well, that would be the same sentiment in 19th century. Nobody really cares, but some cared. We have galleries. Do everybody, even if they're free, does everybody take the time to go to them? No. And what determines who pursues that? Is it because there's a lot of different pressures in life? Some lives are harder than others. And then we live in a system of that perpetuates exploitation, doesn't it? Ouch. You might find some of this is thinking is slightly facile, but his influence amongst contemporaries and those who followed him was tremendous. He was a spokesman for the American Transcendentalists, a group of romantic writers. It included Thoreau, you know. That guy, that rich guy sitting on the edge of the lake, thinking and reading, and who believed that intuition was the means to truth, that God is revealed through intuition to each individual. Well, when we look around at the breakdown of organized religion, not the faith, but the organizations, this is an alternative, isn't it? And they celebrated the independent individual and strongly supported democracy. So in this essay, Self-Reliance, it was an excerpt, but we're going to present an excerpt here. Now, his variety of individualism grows from the self's intuitive connection with the oversoul and is not simply a matter of self-centered assertion or immature narcissism. There is a time in every man's education when he arrives at the conviction that envy is ignorance, that imitation is suicide, and that he must take himself for better or worse at his portion. And through the wide universe is full of good. No kernel or nourishing corn can come to him but through his toil bestowed on that plot of ground which is given to him to till. Whosoever would be a man must be a nonconformist. He who would rather gather immortal palms must not be hindered by the name of goodness, but must explore if he is goodness. Nothing is at last sacred but the integrity of his own mind. Absolve you to yourself, and you shall have the suffrage of the world. I remember an answer which, when quite young, I was prompted to make to a valued advisor who was wont to importune me with the dear old doctrines of the church. And on my saying, what have I to do with the sacredness of traditions if I live wholly from within, my friend suggested, but these impulses may be from below, not from above. And I replied, do they not seem to me to be such? But if I am the devil's child, I will live then from the devil. No law can be sacred to me but that of my own nature. God and good and bad are but names, but very readily transferable to this or that. The only right is what is after my constitution. The only wrong, what is against it. What I must do is all that concerns me, not what people think. This rule, equally arduous in actual and in intellectual life, may serve for the whole distinction between greatness and meanness. It is the harder because you will always find those who think they know what is your duty better than you know it. It is easy for the world to live after the world's opinion. It is easy in solitude to live after your own. You see the thinking. It's an interesting conclusion or an assumption that we leap to when we think about the living within your own nature. Obviously, the thinking is that person will do wrong. That person will exploit. That person will be mean and take advantage. That person will be destructive. In other words, is the outside influence is what moderates. And yet when we look around, that certainly is not the popular sentiment. We have to cling optimistically. The Epicureans amongst us are a smaller group than the Cynics and the Stoics. There's a resignation that nothing really has changed. And in fact, we struggle to make any progress at all. Well, if that's the case, then are we examining our own self-defeating assumption here? That given the opportunity or taking the opportunity to rely on your own nature is daunting. Because you couldn't really make that up as you go along. You would need to understand your own nature. And is your own nature evil or good, positive or not? It's just to get to the point, that position of being able to be what the word would we use these days, self-directed, requires a fair amount of self-examination. This was, in some ways, Emerson's work was quite original. The soul always hears an admonition in such lines. Let the subject be what it may. The sentiment they instill is of more value than any thought they may contain. To believe your own thought, to believe what is true for you in your private heart is true of all men. That is genius. Speak your latent conviction and it shall be the universal sense, for the inmost in due time becomes the outmost, and our first thought is rendered back to us by the trumpets of the last judgment. Familiar as the voice of the mind is to each, the highest merit we ascribe to Moses, Plato, and Milton is that they set at naught books and traditions and spoke not what men, but what they thought. A man should learn to detect and watch that gleam of light which flashes across his mind from within. And I'll leave it with this. There's more, far more you can imagine. This is just an excerpt. Man is his own star. And the soul that can render an honest and a perfect man commands all light, all influence, all fate. Nothing to him falls early, nor too late. Our acts, our angels are, or good or ill, our fatal shadows that walk by us still. Reasonable question? Too harsh. Asking too much of us, isn't it? Or not? You can see where this would empty the room. I can. And I still carry this myth that, oh, the room should be full of all men that are capable of this kind of reflection, except I've never been in that kind of room. I don't, and I'm guessing, or am I really thinking that it would be better off if the lodge was full of the likes of me? bit paradoxical, isn't it? If searching within myself, then I would expect everybody else to be having the same opportunity. Search within yourself for the ideas. And how do we do that? Well, we do that with a sense of conviviality, always. That atmosphere. We struggle to make it beautiful, and we compromise. And one level of compromise is what's tolerable, and another level of compromise is what's not tolerable. But the process continues. Here. So has that galvanized, has that changed your thinking about our desires and the end game of masonry? Is it to, if we're influenced greatly to toward the light, or if we're influenced by and we achieve some level of knowledge and wisdom, is that setting us free? Is that self-reliance? Thank you. Today we're going to get into a bit more of our history, of course. And it's a reminder that whatever change happens in your life or my life or within the broader strides of Freemasonry, the change, the evolution that I often speak about, the unstoppable evolution, the unstoppable search and discovery, is gradual. And that doesn't suggest that we don't have those moments, those aha moments or the epiphany. No, but step back, look at the landscape, and you think it's gradual. It's like more like a breeze than a torrent, than a storm. This work that history that we've been walking through is examining that point of transition. We talk about it within our order and struggle, if you will, if this seems to be ideologically driven or fact driven or a little bit of both, you know, that there was a transition from operative masonry to speculative masonry, and we refer to ourselves that way. That was, as we see here, at least in this one lodge, and no reason to take their records as being misleading. It was driven by the need for a revenue stream. For whatever reason, the operative masons in the area grew thin, and the numbers became thin. So rather than watch the decline, they did something, and something that must have been a difficult. So if I ask all of you, unfairly as it is, to put yourself in those shoes, where do you stand? Would we stand still and in our heart want the purity of the order to be valued until the last moment and just accept that there is not enough today to support what we believe and what we have? Let it go. Or would you do compromise? Would you try to find answers? Well, noble to attempt to find answers, but a bit awkward if we're not sure and clear what the questions are we should be answering. What is going on? Or are we looking more deeply into incentives and value? We don't seem to be completely convinced that club atmosphere is enough. Although it seems to, within the order, it's prevalent. Outside the order, when you think about it, when the 7 billion of the human beings, our internal debates and concerns aren't necessarily being addressed. No. We are old guys, and we are part of history. We are part of, in some ways, like us or not, we're something that legitimates, offers some sense of continuity to the world around us. Well, I don't know if everybody thinks nobly about us. I don't know anymore if people really care. And our lackluster show places, our worn out themes, that's all. We've allowed them to become worn. Like those, you ever been in a place where people have walked for thousands of years and you see the hardened stone smoothed off and it dips where repeated steps have occurred. Maybe that's enough for us to realize that it takes a certain imagination to be able to create the beautiful atmospheres that we were talking about, that humans, that we're assuming here, in like way Plato may have something, Aristotle may have disagreed, of course, with forms, but they both agreed that our desire for wisdom was what brought us together. And here is this formula of history and philosophy and conviviality in need of some form of compromise. I think before we get there about compromise, that we look more deeply into things that are really putting the focus on us. We've shied away from the artistry of masonry, although we might look at it. If I talk to you like, here's the history of Dundee Lodge, hundreds of years ago, I can extrapolate by the way that I talk about it, a sense of desirability and beauty and charm and grace that we know might not have been there. In fact, about 1969, I was at a big concert with hundreds of thousands of people. And it was, if I think back on it, it was wet and there was mud, but that's, and now at my age, with a bit of trepidation, I look back at it, it was wonderful. It was an elevation of the human spirit. So when I'm attending or giving a eulogy, I don't talk about the shortcomings of a man. And when a man is down and out, I don't mock him by pointing out that, he has only himself to blame. Like, that's self-serving and selfish. You make the best of it if you can. Oh, not everybody can do that. But I can and you can if you have the choice. I guess that comes from the inspiration of seeing somebody very, very sick, very sick, who looks across and sees somebody and smiles and tries to encourage that person because that person's more ill than they are. I love that kind of compassion. I love that. And that's a lesson worth living. Here, as non-Masons were being admitted to the Dundee Lodge, it continued to believe that its freedoms and privileges within the town were worth a reasonable sum. There's something in this. The £10 Scott's membership fee requested was still less than the £16 paid by a working journeyman to procure his privileges and status as a master in the lodge. Entry fees were not always uniformly applied, and in no sense at this moment could the humble craft of Dundee Masons be imagined as an elite organization. All of that would gradually change. The records are clear that preference for admission of non-craftsmen was to be given to relatives or actually operative Masons. There was a predictably large number of such sons and sons-in-law admitted to the guild during the 18th century. They could be of any occupation. By far the largest number of new members who are not practicing Masons, but who tell us their occupations, are described as merchants, and also as a clock and watchmaker, a draper, a wright, a maltman, an officer of the excise, 1721, a surgeon, and finally in the 1730s, a supervisor of the excise, a doctor of medicine, a shipmaster, a clerk of the customs, and most significantly, landed gentlemen of the county who bear the appellation denoting their gentry origin, honorable. They received the same freedom, now uniformly described as liberties and privileges. These admissions are by far the most interesting from the point of view of subsequent Masonic history. Yet the Dundee records, which at least tell of who and when, are silent about why a man was admitted. We might legitimately ask why this moment and this particular craft. Why did the transition not occur among, let us say, the periwig makers? Given the destruction of the English records, we will never really know if the process we were seeing in early 18th century Dundee was indigenous to the Scottish situations or an attempt to catch up with a trend being exported from England. For our purposes, it's enough to know that the evolution from craft to lodge occurred and that in the process, the everyday practices of a craft guild spread far and away from the working men who invented them. Share with me the rightness of that thinking. Armed with 20/20 hindsight, that means we would have a sense of the history ourselves. Means we'd take a look at it, but not just judge an entire period in history by one paragraph or a few words on a page, but does this confirm some ideas that you've had, or does it open up different considerations? I think it's a wonderful piece. It's the reality that is erasing part of the myth and replacing it with something I think better. Yeah. And to those men long ago who asked me the question, put me on the spot is in a friendly way, who were the first Freemasons, builders of the pyramids. It really does need to be an historic link, but yeah, sure. If it works for you. Here. This will work for you, I'm sure. I get along without you. Yeah, I know, tongue in cheek. I get along without you very well, by Chet Baker.
I get along without you very well. Of course I do, except when soft rains fall and drip from leaves, then I recall the thrill of being sheltered in your arms. Of course I do. But I get along without you very well. I've forgotten you just like I should. Of course I have, except to hear your name someone's laugh that is the same. But I've forgotten you just like I should. What a guy. What a fool am I to think my breaking heart could kid the moon? What's in store? Should I fall once more? No, it's best that I stick to my tune. I get along without you very well. Of course I do. Except perhaps in spring. But I should never think of spring, for that would surely break my heart into.
I must admit that's the very first piece of music from Chet Baker that doesn't have him playing his trumpet. In fact, all his friends around the studios had to encourage him to record some songs because he would be singing in the background, and he was a trumpet player, session man. Good for us, eh? Well, I hope you've liked the show today. Thank you very much for sitting in. There's so much more, so many more questions to answer and more questions to ask. And I think we're making progress, although our media may not be taking that so kindly. But ask yourself, when you look at our leaders, and they may be quite natural leaders, but do they also have a sense of where to lead us? That's not the easiest question, is it? Anyway, if it was easy, everybody would be doing it. Everybody would be doing it. In the meantime, thank you for tuning in, and commit those acts of random Masonic kindness, and I'll look forward to sitting in with you soon. Masonic effects, and absolutely an acquired taste. See you. Mm-hmm.